Hello and welcome to Behind the Health Statistic. My name is Ricky Hellier. I'm a lecturer at Cardiff University School of Healthcare Sciences. Today I'll be talking to Rhiannon Jones about her lived experience of anorexia nervosa. So what is anorexia nervosa? Well, it's more commonly referred to as just anorexia, and it's an eating disorder and a serious mental health condition. We think there's around about 1.25 million people in the UK who have an eating disorder. Around about 25% of those affected by an eating disorder are male. People often have a distorted image of their bodies. They think they're fat even when they're underweight. What happens is that people with anorexia try to keep their weight as low as possible by not eating enough food or exercising too much or a combination of the both. This can lead to illness due to starvation and death if not addressed. However, research suggests that around about 46% of people with anorexia go on to fully recover. 33% of people originally identified as having the condition are classified as improving, however 20% remain chronically ill. Men and women of any age can get anorexia, but it's most common in young women and typically starts in mid-teens. Although many eating disorders develop during adolescence, it's not entirely unusual for people to develop eating disorders at any stage in their life. Cases of anorexia have been documented in children as young as 6, and the reports of anorexia amongst people in their 70s. A recent study by Hay et al. Found that anorexia accounted for around about 8% of all eating disorders. Avoidant, restrictive food intake disorders account for around about 5%. Binge eating disorders account for around about 22%. Bulimia, 19%. And other specified feeding or eating disorders, 47%. So now over to Rhiannon, and let's hear her story.
Hiya, so I'm here with Rhiannon, who's kindly agreed to sort of have a chat with us today and tell us her story. So, hi Rhiannon.
Hello.
Okay, could you just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself then?
Well, obviously my name's Rhiannon. I'm 25 and I'm currently working as a childminder's assistant.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. How long have you been doing that?
About 2 years almost. Yeah. But yeah.
Enjoy it?
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good working with like the little kids and stuff, so it's nice.
Oh, Lush, what ages do you work with?
They range all the way from about 9 months up to 12 years of age. So there's quite a range, but it's nice, especially around Christmas time.
Oh, Lush, that's brilliant. So you kindly agreed to talk to us a little bit about your eating disorder?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fun. Thank you for doing this.
That's okay.
So can you sort of like tell us about life pre sort of diagnosis and pre sort of you identifying that there was an issue?
Yeah, of course. So I actually went to Cardiff Uni myself when I was about 18 studying genetics. And then when I was about in my second year, I started, I was fine with eating, everything was fine. And then I started wanting to diet. And then this just got out of control. But it took us quite a while, whilst I was losing the weight, to even get a diagnosis of it being an eating disorder. So everyone was just like, oh, she's just lost weight, to the point where it's like, oh, maybe she should stop now. And it carried on. And we went to the doctors. It must have been probably about 6 months after I started like severely dieting, and I'd lost quite a lot of weight. And at that point I was below the BMI of 17.5, so I was in that anorexia category, but I still wasn't that low as some girls get. So they were kind of a bit like, oh yeah, you are got an eating disorder sort of thing, you do have anorexia, but we're not, they don't take it as serious when you're not as quite as low. So that can obviously make you a bit like, oh, I'm not that ill, I can just carry on doing what I want to do. So, but I didn't, I ended up getting better, but we had to get better on my own because she sent through a referral for like a dietitian and mental health book, because my weight wasn't that low. It ended up that it didn't go through for like ages and ages, like 6 months, a year, I think it was. It was a really long time. So we just kind of got better on my own at my own house. I kind of carried on with my life. And then I relapsed. And this time, because it never really went, because I didn't have the help, it always kind of stayed in my head. So I gained the weight back. But the actual eating disorder itself, there was still a lot of rules there. And the thing is with eating disorders is once there's rules, once you give it an inch, it will gradually take a mile and take over your life again. So it's just kind of downward spiral from there. And that time I did get very, very low and ended up going as an inpatient into a hospital. And from there, it's just been a long journey of getting better now to this point.
Yeah. And you're in a good place with it now?
Yeah, I'm much better place, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So prior to you sort of developing your sort of eating disorder, were you like previously sort of what you'd call fit and healthy? Or?
Yeah, fine. I played football. I just normally, like any person would, it was kind of quite out of the blue, I think, that everyone was a bit like, what?
Yeah. So have they ever got to like an identification of, like you said, you started off just trying to lose a bit of weight, which is obviously quite common. What was your drivers behind that then? Why did you want to lose weight?
I'm not really sure. I'm not sure whether I just started uni and like gained a bit that people tend to do, because obviously you're cooking your own food, you tend to have takeaways a lot as a student, and then drinking a lot. So I'm not sure whether I decided, oh, I just want to diet and be healthy sort of thing. I was in a flat with like a couple of other girls that were kind of like, oh, I'm going to like sort of be, they weren't extreme or anything. They just decided they were going to eat healthy some nights or go to the gym or something like that. But I just had that personality where once I started, it almost became like an addiction and I couldn't stop.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you said an addiction is
yeah.
Yeah, are you normally that sort of type of personality then?
I'm not sure. Like, I don't smoke or anything like that, but I do tend to once... I'm very good at, like, making routines and patterns and rules for myself and, like, following it. So when I was, like, studying my A-levels, I had, like, a timetable and I would follow that religiously and things like that. It's quite that perfectionist, following the rules sort of personality that means once you start a diet and you're like, I'm not going to eat chocolate, most people then break that rule, whereas I found that I didn't break that rule ever.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you start, so you started losing weight as part of your dieting, and when did it become a point that you sort of recognised, hang on, this is not quite right, this is maybe, you know, gone past dieting now?
I think I kind of knew fairly soon sort of like I'm counting calories a lot here. I'm nowhere near where I should be with the calories. Like I'm limiting these quite a lot. But that almost gave me a buzz and drove me on. It was almost like I knew it was a problem, but at the same time, I didn't care because I enjoyed that I could eat under and I enjoyed watching the scales go down.
Yeah.
So it meant that I didn't actually talk to anyone about it.
Right, okay. Yeah, but you said other people might have started to notice. So who noticed, first of all, then?
So obviously I was in uni, so, like, my flatmates and stuff started noticing. Like, it starts off with, like, oh, you've lost a bit of weight, you look good sort of thing, like people do. And then it was getting to the point of, oh, you've still lost weight. And then my parents obviously saw me and were like, what is going on? Like, we've never seen you this skinny in our lives. Like, what is happening sort of thing. Yeah. And then from there, and then second time round, I didn't want there to be a problem. It was almost like it had come back without me realizing. I couldn't stop, but at the same time, I didn't want to admit it had come back. So I kind of just sort of shrugged it off, like, oh no, I just don't want to eat that. Oh no, I just don't want that. Oh, I just don't fancy that, rather than actually going, oh, okay, actually, this is a problem. I need to fight this. It was almost like, by the time I noticed, I was out of energy to fight it. So I just carried on with it.
Yeah. And how did it sort of affect you day to day? So you said, like, you sometimes, you know, on the first bout, you got a bit of a buzz about it. And the second bout was slightly different. But you know, like, sort of physically and mentally, how was it impacting on you?
It makes you very zombie, I would say, because at the start, all you're thinking about, it's like ironic really, but all you're thinking about is food, even though it's a thing you're most scared to have. So either you're thinking about what you're going to eat, planning your meals, counting calories, either stressing because you ate something that was a bit out of your rules, something like that. And then the smaller you get, it's almost like your body's calling out for food, so your brain won't switch off about it. Like, I remember I used to walk past all these like takeaway places to get to where I was going, and I pretty much knew the items on the menus all the way down because my brain would just automatically see them and read them because I think it was pretty much by that point, like, oh my God, we just need to eat sort of thing. So you tend to not be able to engage in conversations very much. So especially the second time, I sort of went in on myself. You lock yourself away from people because you don't want to go to social situations, because social situations always involve food. Like, most people that don't have an eating disorder don't realize this. They're just like, oh, do they? But they do. Like, so you tend to not go out with friends very much. So you kind of lock yourself away. It made me really throw myself into work and studies and things like that, because it was almost like a distraction, I suppose. And then the second bout, because I did get so low energy wise, it was getting to the point that I had to like catch the train and walk up the train station steps, and I used to take about 5 or 10 minutes to walk up there because I'd have to like do one step, breathe, and I was like an old person. I had to like will my legs to move by the end of it. Like, by the time I went into hospital, I couldn't actually physically jump or anything like that because the muscles had gone away. So that obviously affected a lot, and it makes you cold, very cold. I think I was running at like a good, I don't know, my temperature was about 35 maybe below, and that was inside with fleeces and gloves and hats on, sort of thing.
Yeah God, that's frightening, really, isn't it, you know?
Oh yeah, it was like they caught me quick before I, like, they were like, your organs are going to fail, we don't know how you're alive, get into hospital.
Absolutely. Can I ask you, you know, it's you mentioned your sort of your flatmates and your mum and dad noticing something going wrong. How did you sort of react to them noticing something was going wrong?
To be honest, like, obviously people are worried, and that makes you be like, oh no, like it kind of triggers something in your brain, but you're quite disconnected by it at that point because you're terrified people are gonna make you stop and make you eat again. So I would either shrug things off, but I kind of quite enjoyed people, not enjoyed people being worried about me, but the whole like, oh, you're too skinny now. I almost saw that as a compliment rather than it being a concern. It almost didn't come across correctly in my brain.
Yeah, that makes sense, what you're saying. It makes absolute sense what you're saying. And did it sort of like, so did it affect relationships then with other people?
Yeah, like my friends are real good and they stayed by me, but it did mean that they wouldn't see me for like months on end. Like my family themselves, like me and my mum had a lot of arguments. Like, we're good now because we've always been very close, but we would like bash horns a lot because they would want me to eat, I wouldn't. Like, there would be big screaming matches sort of thing, because obviously she's a concerned mother. But so it did. Luckily for me, it never affected anything permanently. It just meant for the time being, I maybe didn't see my friends, but they were good and stayed in contact with me and things like that. Or like I said, me and my mum would have a lot of arguments, but she's still there for me now and good as gold. It's just at that time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like you've got great parents, doesn't it? You know,
yeah,
concerned about you and everything, you know, that's lovely. And this sounds like a really sort of, I don't know whether it's like a big existential question or something, but in terms of like your views of health, like, imagine, because sometimes people's views of health change. Has it changed over a period of time, almost like pre-diagnosis, during, after, where you are now sort of thing?
What do you mean, as in like terms of health, as in the health service, or like what I see as healthy?
Or what you feel is healthy, what you see as healthy.
Yeah, I think it has, because obviously most people grow up with the social media. You've got to be a certain BMI or look a certain figure to sort of be in the health bracket, if that makes sense. Whereas I think the world's starting to change and understand that some people like need, like, do have higher BMIs, yet they're still healthy, or like they would have to diet and like cycle and exercise to the extreme to actually be a normal BMI. So, or like some people are the opposite, and they're like, my one friend, she's tiny, she's always been tiny, I think her BMI's always been underweight, but she eats like a horse and she's healthy and she's fine. It's just how she is. So I think it's not quite as this is healthy, this is not anymore. It's more like that there's many different factors to say that you're healthy as well. Like, you need to be able to eat a variety diet, exercise but not feel like you have to do it and not do it all the time sort of thing for like thousands of hours a day. And yeah, it's just got slightly broader, I think, than the traditional, this is how much you should exercise, this is what you should eat, and this is the size you should be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. Because, you know, with eating disorders, the as well, the blame often gets laid at social media, doesn't it, for a lot of people. Was that ever a factor for you?
I don't think so, because I'm not a very big social media person. So I think almost, I suppose, obviously, I had the pressure that people tend to have of wanting to be a certain figure, but it was never really like I saw a person on, well, I didn't even have Instagram back there. I didn't see a person on Instagram or Facebook. I suppose it must have been TV or just generally that's kind of what people say, that you should have a flat stomach or this size this or this size that kind of thing. But I don't, it wasn't necessarily social media as a big thing. It was just kind of a bit part of it, I think.
It wasn't that cliche of social media in some respects, isn't it? You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. So, you know, when you went into hospital, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I went in to our local general hospital. I went in through EAU, actually, because they did a ECG on me at the doctor's, and I think my heart rate was down to 35. So they sent me straight down the hospital.
Right, yeah.
That's when they kept me in. And then the eating disorders team kind of came and saw me the next day. And like, what they don't tell you is once you're in hospital and you're in that state, you're not allowed to leave. So I was quite happy to be like, oh no, I'm off now, I'm fine. And they were like, yeah, you either stay by will or we're going to make you. And I was like, oh. Mm. So I think the first week or two in there was quite tough because they were trying to get food into me and I was kind of refusing. But the trouble is when you're at that level, like you're a bit crazed and you don't really know what's going on enough to sort of comprehend anything. So I just didn't understand anything. There was just like people giving me food, I didn't want it, so I argued a lot. But once they get like a bit of, it's amazing, like once you get a bit of nutrition into someone with anorexia, I saw it a lot, because later on I went on to like an anorexia unit. After a few days of just getting some normal food, they like wake up a little bit and suddenly they're like a person again. It's the strangest thing. But yeah, so it took a good week or two for them to get that into me because I kept refusing things and stuff. But once I did kind of wake up, I was then like, oh, okay, I see there's a problem. And I think I ended up staying in hospital for about 3 weeks there. Then the plan was for me to go inpatient in a anorexia unit in Marlborough. But there was like a waiting gap, but obviously they don't like you staying in hospital for that. But my mum was like, she cannot go home. So they sent me to like just a kind of like mental hospital to stay on the ward there. But like, I think I was there for 2 weeks, just till they then sent me onto the inpatient unit there. And then on the inpatient unit, then I think I was there for about 6 months.
Yeah. How did you feel about that, going to the psychiatric unit before you went onto the eating disorder unit?
I was terrified actually at first, especially when I got there, because there was no other girls there and there was all these grown men and I was terrified. I was like, what is going on here? But actually, once I got to know them and got to know the staff there, I think those places have a lot of taboo, but they're actually fine. Like, it was lovely. It was quite nice. Like, more patients came in and I chatted to some. Like, obviously you get the odd person, but you would in any hospital situation. But like I said, I was terrified at first and hated it, but actually got to quite like it there. It was quite nice. It was the same as any other hospital, just the fact that you had more of a day room because you had sofas and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you had your own dorms.
Nice, yeah. And what sort of things did they do with you on a day-to-day basis? What did the staff do for you?
In the psychiatric hospital, they didn't really do very much. Like, there wasn't much planned. They did play Mario Kart with me quite a lot.
Right, yeah.
Other than that, they didn't actually, like, have much OT activities there, I think. They were, like, trying to build it up, but they did say that they struggled for them there. So they just tended to let you do your own thing and just kept an eye on you, I suppose. But then on the inpatient unit for the anorexia, that was very much... there were certain groups that you had to go to. It was quite like a regimented thing because they had to feed you up as well. You were on like 3 snacks and 3 meals a day. So like every few hours you were at that table eating as well. And like, than with the inpatient unit, because they're scared that you're going to get up and exercise after you've eaten. If you've eaten, I think for the main meals, you had to stay on rest, so basically stay in the social area, and you had to sit on, like, pick a seat, like on the sofa, and you were not allowed to move. Like, you could not stand up, you could not go to the toilet, you were not allowed to go anywhere for, like, an hour, because they were scared, like, you, like, some girls would make themselves sick, or they would exercise, or just generally moving. So, and then after snacks, so, like, the snacks will be like a cereal bar, you still had to sit for, I think it was half an hour after them. So you spent a lot of time in that social area with those girls as well, because like, you would either be eating or then sat for ages, and then you'd have, like, I don't know, an hour or two to yourself, where then you would be probably in a group doing something, because they did, like, DBT and CBT, and they did, like, contemplation group as well. They did quite a few different groups, and then you were back eating again or sitting, kind of thing. The days were very regimented there.
And how did you feel about that? Because that's you know, like you said, regimented is the main word with that, isn't it? And I had, because my background is I'm an adult nurse. You know, I don't work in mental health. It's something I've not come across. How did you feel about being in that sort of care plan, if you like?
It's tough because it just feels like a very pretty prison, basically. That's how I used to describe it. It was very much like you listened to the rules, you did as you were told. And they would sort of, like, we were allowed 10 minutes, like, depending on your BMIs, once you got to a certain BMI, you're allowed 1 10-minute walk outside a day with, like, the staff. It was called fresh air, and you all just got walked around the hospital. And then once you got to another BMI, you're allowed 2 of them. But, like, if you broke the rules, they would take that away from you. Or if, like, you would have home leave on the weekend, if you broke the rules, they would stop you going home. They were very much, like, regimented with it. And, like, at the time, it seems harsh and horrible, and you really do play up for it. Yeah. But it stops you breaking those rules, and then it sort of means that you do kind of get forced into getting better. And the thing is, with eating disorders, especially when you're low in the unit, the more nutrition they get into you, the more your brain suddenly starts functioning. And then you get up to a certain BMI and suddenly it doesn't click off. It's still a battle because all those rules and stuff are ingrained into you. But it makes it a lot easier for you to go, oh, actually, this is wrong. This is something I need to fight rather than something I need to follow. So, like I said, at the time, I was like, what is this? But gradually you get used to it and sort of get broken down a bit like a horse and submissive to it. But then you realise it was for your own good. Like, the reason they make you sit there is because when you've got anorexia or an eating disorder, even, like, the slightest movement of getting up and walking, I don't know, 3 steps and sitting back down, you would then feel like you needed to do that. Even though it wouldn't affect your weight, you would feel like that it might, or you need to do it. But then that's your eating disorder remaining there. So then there's more likely chance that 3 steps come 4 steps and 5 steps. And next minute, once you're at the unit, it's becoming miles rather than just a few steps. So they try and get everything out of you, almost give you a blank slate, so you have no rules to go home with.
Yeah. That makes and you said about socializing with people, you know, with other people with eating disorders. How do you find that?
It can be difficult. I wasn't one that got triggered too easily by things, so I wasn't too bad. There was a lot of conversations were banned, so obviously you weren't allowed to talk about BMIs or weight gain or weight loss or things like that. But we were all there to support each other because you live with these people and you're all going through the same thing. You become very close. But so you are all there to support each other is good, and it's always good to have almost someone that understands with you. It's just making sure, when I first went there, someone turned to me and was like, choose your friends wisely. And that's what you've got to do in there, because there's some girls in there that they've kind of in sections and stuff, they don't want to be in there, and they'll just break every rule, or they'll just eat, get out and go back downhill sort of thing. So you have to almost, if you want to get better, pick the people that are going to support you. So I had a good group of friends that we all supported each other. If one was scared of one thing, we'd be like, oh, well, I'll do that with you if you do this with me sort of thing. And we worked together to get there.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that sounds lovely. It's almost like that thing sometimes, I think, when we're giving health advice out, we can see it from one standpoint, but we've not been through it. You know, most of us haven't been through the things that our clients, our patients, you know, that we're caring for have. So It's interesting you talking about that and the peer-to-peer support, but just being mindful. That's really, really interesting. Yeah,
I know they're really scared of it with eating disorders, that they're all going to get competitive and go back on each other. But I think as long as you've got someone there, obviously, almost keeping an eye, and you have, like, we had a lot of groups where if somebody did get triggered by something or was struggling with something, it was like an open group where you could talk about it and say. So there was no secrets almost. So if someone started saying something, you're like, oh, that's kind of triggering me. You talked it out so that it didn't cause a problem, if that makes sense. Yeah. And yeah, it's nice to have that support, because like I was a big advocate that they shouldn't keep people with eating disorders separate. Like they needed to almost be like watched by somebody that didn't have the eating disorder to make sure that they didn't cause each other to go back downhill. But as long as they were all trying to get better and being supportive, there's nothing better than like two of you sort of being there. Because like on that unit, we were at such a state that like if our juice was like 2 millimeters over what it should be, we would be like screaming and crying and stuff. So it was nice to have someone that understands to go, it's okay. Because with the staff and stuff, as much as they said it, you'd be like, you don't understand.
Yeah. So, yeah. And with the staff you worked with, what did you, it's something we ask, you know, we've been asking in all these interviews.
Yeah.
What made a good healthcare professional for you? What sort of things did they do that made you think, oh, this is good? And maybe some of the things you thought, hang on, I wish they'd avoid doing that, you know?
Yeah, on that unit, they got to know you really well, because obviously it's kind of like 24-hour care, so you saw them a lot. And the ones we kind of, I suppose, like the best was they would listen, because obviously eating disorders, you have your stereotypical textbook kind of things, but you also have, everyone's is also so different. So I knew if I was talking to someone, because I'd been through it so much by this time, I knew when someone was giving me a textbook answer and when someone had actually listened to me and was trying to help. Because, like, you, by this point, you've been given the same answer so long and probably researched it so much yourself. You know when someone's going, oh, yeah, well, that's typical of eating disorders. You're like, I've heard this before. And then you kind of switch off. But someone that actually listens and goes, okay, I'm going to try and help you. Maybe try this. Maybe try this idea sort of thing. They were really good. And then sometimes they just took time with you. Like, sometimes you'd be upset with something and they would just take you away and rather talk about it. They would like just play a game with you for a bit and calm you down and make sure you're okay sort of thing. Like, I took that extra care, I suppose, rather than just being like, oh yeah, get on with it.
Yeah, yeah, like you said, the Mario Kart, you know, that's
exactly stuck.
yeah. So you transitioned then into sort of getting better in yourself. And you moved to a place where you're sort of, you know, recovering now. Tell us a little bit about that. So you were discharged from hospital?
Yeah, so I left the unit and then I was put into the care of, they're called like tier 3 eating disorders specialists in the mental health team. And so I was been in their care then for, well, I've almost been discharged from that unit. It'd be like 2 years come October. So I would have been in their care for like almost 2 years, because I've been discharged from them back in July. So they were really good. So they kind of picked me up where I left off, because obviously I was having pretty much all my meals supported. Like, I was in the low support room, which means basically I was in another room to, like, basically when you're eating meals, you start on low, high support, where that you have like a patient, then a staff member, a patient, then a staff member in between all of them on the table. Then you kind of transition to medium support, where there's like one or two staff members on the table, but mainly just patients. And then you transition into low support, where it's just patients in there, and you choose your own snacks. So you have the responsibility to kind of like go shopping and buy your own snacks, rather than being like, we had set menus, so you'd be off their snack rotation and pick your own. So I was used to kind of that level of support, and then coming out was like, oh, what am I going to do? So they kind of picked off and I would tend to have a meal support session once a day with someone. So someone would come for either a meal or a snack once a day, and they did that for 2 weeks. And then once I was okay with that, I kind of didn't want to know straight away and sort of relapse a bit slightly. I was kind of finding my feet, I think, suddenly being at home, picking my own meals or things like that. There was a lot of things at that unit where they were very measured, and that sent me into stir crazy mode, where I think we had like 200 mil of juice. So I had to specifically measure my juice. So I'd be getting jugs out, milk out, things like that to try and measure it and be really set on portions. So then, and like I had a meal plan and I stuck religiously to that as well. And like I wouldn't have takeaways. There was still a lot of rules. So then that meant because those rules were still there, I kind of like progressed up and down quite a lot really whilst I was with the specialist eating disorder team. To the point where in February they turned to me and they were like, look, you are just going downhill to the point where you're going to end up back there. That's your two options. They were like, you either fix this. They gave harsh love by this point because they're like, you've had all the therapy, you've done everything you can. So they were like, so you either, we take a step back, let you crack on and then we'll weigh you, catch you and you'll end up back in hospital, or you fix it. And I got to the point where I was like, I'm bored of this. I'm fed up with this. I'm going to fix it. And then from there, I sort of, they were really supportive then. And once you want to work on something, they're there for you. So then they just kind of helped me get from sort of having these strict rules to sort of breaking them. So they start off with like, not to overwhelm eating disorder people, I think, by giving you like portion sizes, like, I don't know, like butter is the top of your thumb and like Nutella is a teaspoon of it, things that normal people just don't do and have way more of, basically. Yeah. So I turned to them and was like, I know all the kind of like portion sizes now, I'm not going to listen to them and I'm going to do what my mum does and what I was with my boyfriend at the time. So my boyfriend that I'm with now, I was like, I'm going to copy them and model that and model what I think is normal. And then gradually as I did that, almost I went back 5 years and could actually remember what I used to do, like, oh, I used to put this much Nutella on or this much peanut butter. And like, I'm not going to panic about which juice glass I drink because it doesn't really matter how much juice I have. It's a glass of juice sort of thing. And that made a big difference for me. It was almost like the unit helped me get physically better, but mental wise, teaching me all the sort of portions and stuff was good because I understood what was too little by then. But at the same time, it made me so rigid that I couldn't break from those portions. So to live normal, like some of those portions were to the point where it was like, you can't keep these rules, if that makes sense. If you want to live a life, you can't just keep measuring 200 millimeters of juice every morning. So yeah, so that made a big difference when I turned around to them and was like, oh no, I'm not gonna do that. But that was scary for me because I thought they'd be like, no, you must stick to your portions. But they're like, oh yeah, that's good. As long as you don't go under, we're happy, do what you want.
Yeah, yeah. That's...
yeah.
Oh, sorry. No, that's great. It's such an interesting story, Rhianna. And honestly, it's really interesting. So you mentioned your boyfriend. So where and your job and stuff. And so how are you now? How is life now with you?
It's really good, actually. Me and my boyfriend have bought a house, and it's needed a lot of work. But he's he's an electrician, but he's also owns like a building company with his dad, so he can do most of it. So they've been literally doing that up for us.
That's so, very handy then, isn't it? Yeah.
So that's good. I'm actually 16 weeks pregnant tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Ariane, so that's amazing. Wow. Yeah.
So,
new house, new baby.
Yeah, totally different life.
Yeah, definitely. Work going well and everything.
Yeah, definitely.
And you'll have the experience actually working with the kids as well, isn't it? You know, so.
Exactly.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Oh, that's really good news, Rhianna.
Thank you.
That's lovely. And I've kept you for ages. I was only going to keep you about 20 minutes.
Oh, but, no, that's all right.
Honestly, we're so grateful for you sharing your story. And I think it's lovely. There's just a really happy ending as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So what I'll do, Rhianna, is I'll say thank you for that. And I'm sure everyone will sort of like appreciate you sharing your story. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
So a massive thank you to Rhianna for sharing her story with us. If you'd like more information on anorexia or eating disorders more widely, please look at the NHS website or look at organisations such as beateatingdisorders.org.uk. Thank you.